Hi there everybody, welcome to Sheep Fan Podcast, and in episode 77 we're speaking with musician, citizen journalist and excellent researcher Johnny Vedmore. Last year when I was researching Sir Klaus Schwab for our upcoming podcast, I came across a blog written by Johnny called Schwab Family Values. His blog sent me off in new directions of research and corroborated some of my own research. I reached out to Johnny last year, but he was abroad at the time and didn't know about my contact. However, via a Sheep Farm listener and fellow podcaster, we made contact a couple of weeks ago. Johnny is a passionate speaker. Well, he's from Wales. He's also a tenacious researcher. He is a walking encyclopedia. And it was great to sit back and listen to him. Now, unfortunately, Johnny's connection was absolutely dreadful, and it's taken me at least 5 or 6 hours to edit this down and get rid of the really bad parts. So I apologise for that, but it is listenable, and his information is interesting, to say the least. Also, you won't hear our Chris on this, because his microphone finally went kaput, thankfully, so he's had to go and put his hand in his pocket and buy a new one, which I've been nagging him for, I don't know how long, over a year anyway. So when we next record, he will have a new microphone. He does pop in and out of this one, but some of his exchanges were minefields going off, so I had to cut him out. So I do hope you enjoy it. Thanks for tuning in. Bye. Right, welcome to Sheep Farm Podcast, and with me and our Chris tonight, we've got a Welshman with us for once. For the first time, we've got a Welsh man on the show. Yeah. This chap, again, hello, it's Johnny Vedmore. I don't know if anybody's heard some of his podcasts. And I came across Johnny about a year ago when we were researching our podcast on Schwab, and I spotted some of his work online, a blog he'd written called The Schwab Family Values, with the They Live Schwab, Obey, Consume, etc. Picture, which was quite striking. Just quickly, did you have that designed, Johnny? Who designed that picture?
Yes, I did. I actually, like, when Trump came into power, I'm a musician as well, when Trump came into power, I was taking the piss, a sarcastic version idea of that, and I used this guy's work, Hal Hefner. His name's Hal Hefner, and he did loads of They Live portraits. And when I wrote up the Schwab Family Values article, obviously it was like massive. It was the first well-sourced article that showed his actual ancestry, his actual father, and put together the missing links. And we wanted a good picture, striking, and I thought, we've got to get in touch with Hal Hefner, the perfect person for this. All of his They Live's work is just fantastic, and he didn't disappoint. He did a brilliant. It's kind of a bit of my logo now for my Fungi Monkey stuff as well, which is like my media channel. So I do like.
Yeah, it's very good, is that, and it's good that it's picked on that, because it's very apt for what we're going through at the moment, isn't it? The They Live. I mean, you've got to ask yourself on a deeper level: is that actually what we're witnessing right at this minute in time? Because what was it you said? The guy that acted. It's more of a documentary than a film. What was he called? The guy who was
Roddy
the
Piper. He said it was a documentary, not a film.
Yeah. So, so Johnny, what? Rowdy Roddy Piper. Yeah. So, what's your actual background then? You say you're a musician, but are you a journalist, or are you a trained journalist, or is it just something like me and Chris? We picked a mic up and we just started researching.
Kind of, yeah. I was working in hotels for years, so I was like, I was working in hotels. I come from, my dad was a steel worker from South Wales. Mum was a traffic warden. I was like, I was terrible at school. I had something called Graves' disease, like, gave me loads of symptoms that wasn't recognized till I was much older. So in school, I couldn't even concentrate half. I ended up like breaking into houses and setting things on fire all the time, and ended up working for the Hilton. I don't know. That seems like the route you go. Five, six, set things on fire for a bit, then put on your CV, go work for the Hilton. The one that I worked at was a 5-star opening Hilton, where it was like the opening of the Rugby World Cup as well in Cardiff, and it was some. It was debauchery. Times down there, you know, late 90s. But I mean, the whole thing of I didn't think I was going to be a journalist. I didn't think I was going to. It was about 2014 where I had been like trying to make something in music for the past like 6-7 years. I'd been playing for all my life, like from when I was young. I used to enjoy playing stuff, even though I was never given anything to play with. I was like, I'm going to make some sort of sound, something, to write poetry, do something, and eventually picked up a guitar, and I wanted to make something of it for myself anyway. And what I experienced was I went from like the late 90s, talking about there, everybody went like 18, 19, 20, all of these all out there were there was a big music scene. There was, it was wonderful from club to club, and pick up a load of like news and loads of activity going on. It was all wondrous. It was amazing. And by the time we got up to doing that ourselves, by the time we got round, when I was about 27, 28, and I'd had my like surgery on my throat and stuff, and I was able to say, okay, this is my time to get out there, the whole thing was dead. They destroyed it, built up apartments and flats all of the cities. They had closed down all below, and suddenly this was no longer like, you know, all of this behavior that was supposed to be about letting, releasing your angst for, that you build up during a week of hard work or a week of studying or whatever. Then suddenly that wasn't allowed to be brought out like it was in the past, and there was no place to go for it. And suddenly, you know, we went out there, and we were a good band as well. I was from Alaska. We had some really good music going on, really fast guitar, really fun, really good live. You know, a lot of the scene in Cardiff has been going for years and years, and it was just dying. I got out there, it was all dead, and we were really sad. We were trying to live a past that was never going to come back.
I think the millennium, or 9/11 especially, that's when the downhill spiral started, really, wasn't it? After 9/11. So you get to 2014, realize everything's not the same, which it wasn't, certainly wasn't. And it was like the millennium was a party, and the party was to celebrate the end of what we'd had.
Yeah.
That's what the millennium looks like.
I feel you, man. Yeah.
And the party's over now, and we've entered and we're deep into the Schwabian agenda. That we like to call. Ironically, we did a podcast with some mates of ours on Rise Above, Rise Above Live. They've got it's on YouTube, but we have to talk in code words on YouTube because that's how we've got now. The resistance has got where you've got to talk in fucking code words. But anyway, to stay on. So, but we did I've carried on the Schwab sort of tact and gone into the background. And I did a Revenge of the Nerds, which was basically all the young global leaders. All the members who have gone on to form these massive corporations, these technical corporations like Google, Sergey Brin and his partner, the business partner, they were young global leaders, Zuckerberg, Amazon, Bezos, Leeds Bradfordized Bezos, all the guys, Salesforce, you name it, all these people were young Mark global, all of them were young global leaders. And Wikipedia guy and his wife were a young global leader. She was Tony Blair's assistant. All these people were part of Schwab's training. So that's just 10 people. You're not talking about the rest of the crew. And so going back to what you were saying about MySpace, you can understand why all these things were taken. They weren't even just taken over. They've been ingrained now into society where you've got no control.
And it's a very clever. I have articles coming out at some point in the future. I don't know. I got such a long line of articles like waiting to come out in different places. There is a lot of history that goes before this World Economic Forum. Like some of these people, like for instance, Bezos, an article that I will be finishing off eventually. Bezos was actually originally recruited when he was out of university for a project that's very interesting. A hedge fund called D.E. Shaw, David Shaw. David Shaw was a computer game theorist in Yale, I think it was. And basically, he was approached by some people to open up this hedge fund that would work upon game theory and computer modeling for the first time. And one of the first people they recruited was Jeff Bezos. And the guy who, this is in about 1988, I think, 87, 88, he gets recruited straight out of college by David Shaw, alongside the guy who would set up download.com, CNET. Now, you have to understand, this is before the World Wide Web is even properly announced. Yeah, and they're already planning, they're already talking about how they're going to capitalize on this thing that they know is coming and no one else knows is coming. And this is because it was a precursor to the internet, something that was only available to people in universities, mainly across America. It was a closed, kind of closed dash open network that was similar to the internet, and it was called Usenet. And Usenet is an extremely, something I looked into when I was researching Mencius Moldbug, Curtis Yarvin, and his history. And what I discovered when I researched it is that, in actual fact, all of the people who are movers and shakers now in the digital world all talked openly under their own identities and their own name under social media forums on Usenet before the internet was even announced as being created. And it got taken over eventually by Google, who kind of archived the whole of Usenet, archived it, but they destroyed most of it. They destroyed most of it. They hid most of it. They retracted loads of information because these people would be in jail if you knew what they had planning had succeeded in what they did with the internet. When Tim Berners-Lee came out and said, we're going to, I have invented the World Wide Web and it's going to be coming along soon. That announcement was made on YouTube. And a lot of these guys already knew the future digital realm was on its way. They knew it. So Bezos was recruited by D.E. Shaw into this, which was about, D.E. Shaw was about putting these people into the positions of power that would make them, which would capitalize a certain area or sector of the internet that would.
You mean to tell me that Bezos just didn't set Amazon up in his garage?
Yeah, in the back of his he bought a secondhand station wagon. He went to his family and he said, please help me, I've got this idea, can you lend me some money? This is his backstory. In 2000, just a year after he was Time Person of the Year, magazine's Person of the Year, for being this great internet entrepreneur who saw everything before it happened and used to sell books at the back of his station wagon, you know. But a year after that, you see a lot of books being produced about Jeff Bezos where they're trying to say written and by people who are paid by Jeff Bezos to solidify this rumor that it was like a kind of family-run thing. His wife at the back of a station wagon, money they lent from their family. Yes, this is all on this labor, you know, we had a big hedge fund supporting us for all of these years. Well, they had a big hedge fund.
It did, yeah. They had something like 300 million invested into that business over the first, I think, 10 years of it. And but it didn't make a profit. I don't know if it does now, but it didn't make a profit for about 20 years. I remember doing, it was only quick research, but even Facebook, for argument's sake, when Zuckerberg, he went to, was at Harvard, and Larry Summers had him under his wing. And the same thing happened there. The swap Facebook for LifeLog. And the lady, Schanberger, I think she's called, as my mate said, Schanberger of the Bilderberg, she's one of Zuckerberg's partners from Harvard. So there were a number of them that were brought. I mean, let's face it, most of these people, you would not have them. They've got no character. You wouldn't have them fronting a business normally. They're not the type of characters.
Massively important to have people who people don't feel connected to, and people cannot count properly because they don't know how to. They don't know how to. If you don't know how to someone, if you don't understand them being on your wavelength, how are you meant to complain to them? And when you do, and they just look at you like a Borg, like they got nothing behind their eyes, what are you supposed to do then? Chosen for that reason, you know. These guys are chosen as well, often because of the long line of family history.
Oh, yes. There's always that. I mean, we come across probably several things, but there's always two or three things that stand out. Generally, there's got to be some sort of bloodline somewhere where they've been chosen. And it, a lot of times, these people who are shoved into the public eye, I think Chris will agree with me, have generally got some sort of illegitimate bloodline. They're not the core bloodline. They're coming from an illegitimate line. Yeah. And also, they seem to, there's a lot of trauma, whether it's abuse or something like that. There's something attached to something there, not necessarily direct.
Interesting, if you were to look at Jeff Bezos in that through that perspective, remember, he's supposed to be Latino American, is he? Because that's what some people are saying. I think it's got to be a joke, because it's actually, I believe, his stepfather who is of that, who's his adopted stepfather, because he comes from his actual father is. It does seem to have some of like a power somewhere. He's actually, it goes back to people in Norway or Finland who all called Peder Pedersen. Amazing. From like the 1700s, they all look like old witches, smooth old witches, like they're just like Jeff Bezos in a sense. You put a witch's hat on him and he could.
If you look at the people that have been thrown, I mean, obviously you've got Gates, but I mean, we'll leave it to one side. I'm on about the new breed. You've got Bezos, Musk, all these people that have been shoved, the Google guys. You've got Mark II Zuckerberg. You've got all the people that just stare straight through you like they've been either possessed or they've got nothing there that's human within them.
Yeah. You wonder if there's some sort of like... you know, yeah, I don't want to make people with Asperger's sound or like feel really bad, but you get some sort of trait within the sort of like a spectrum of Asperger's, which is really useful for not having some form of emotional response to the situation.
It's funny you should mention that,
and that somehow gets selected.
I remember watching a lecture by a doctor, Suzanne Humphreys. She does. In my other life, we've got an alternative health clinic, and so I study a lot of alternative health stuff. But Suzanne Humphreys, she was a doctor in America who ended up getting the bullet because she was anyway having an argument with the hospital about vaccines, not these vaccines, but childhood vaccines. A lot of kids were coming to her with hepatitis because she was a liver that I think specialist, and she was saying all these kids are coming to me after such and such a jab. So she ended up getting the bullet. Anyway, she was saying that a lot of these kids had some form of learning difficulties or mental difficulties. And she did a lecture on designer autism. And she was saying that the side effects of the bad side of autism is obviously dreadful. But then there's another side of it that makes this type of person equipped for the future. As in, you look at a computer and that's all you do.
Okay, I met someone whose life I would define as like he's on the spectrum, really heavily on the spectrum. He owns a game company called Splash Damage Games, which is a company made the Arkham Asylum games and other right. Really.
Christian would be interested in that one.
Yeah. I knew him from like an ex. It was. Her brother-in-law at the time that split, but they're also their relationships split up as well, so he's no longer with the family. I think I could talk about him a bit. He was one of the biggest arseholes I've met in humanity. I tried to have a conversation. He took us out to he was a very rich guy, and he said, I want you to look look after our baby for the night. So we'll come out to Monaco, and stay at the Monte Carlo Bay Hotel. And then you can look after our baby for a night because I'm so rich. And I went over there. And of course, I'm a Cardiff boy. Like, I really, my dad was a steelworker. I grew up lighting fires all of the time, naughty all of the time. I wasn't from this sort of, like, you know, have designer autism to help me get along in life, if that's what it does, and not get along with people, that's for sure. He was such a, I couldn't even understand how he couldn't understand what he said was
horrible. I think it turns him into sociopaths.
I had some amazing conversations with him about the idea of how he pays his staff, how he gives bonuses out. He gives bonuses to the top people, because what's the point of giving them to the other people? They're not actually, you're not getting anything back. And you want to make sure the people just below you are the people who would, because they'll force the other ones to do it. And it, like, there was a detachment between lived reality and the lived reality of the people who were two steps under him. And he knew it. And if you poked at it enough, because it got to the point where me and him didn't get on along at all. We didn't get on.
That's a surprise. At all.
I was just like, I couldn't help saying to him stuff that it made him really angry. And he would say stuff with a smile on his face about how nasty he was to these people. That if I cared about how he treated someone at all, he'd be like, yeah, I treat them nasty because they deserve it. You know, the real underlining thing was he wanted to cause hate and hurt to somebody else. And when you dig away at it, you know, to everybody else, as far as they're concerned, they're being like, yeah, he's a bit Asperger's in the way he is. He's a bit cut off and he cares about all this stuff. He was almost made for computer business. He was made to make computer games. It was like his brain was like that, you know.
Another side to this, Chris, and you might resonate with this, Chris, and I'm not saying I'm down the ET route here, but when people talk about, I'll use the words grey aliens, that is the type of biological person that you think of, where they've got no emotion or empathy or anything, and they're just going about the business, and if you sort of get in the way, you just get steamrolled.
You just sound like a psychopath, you know, to me, to be fair.
Yeah. Well, anyway, there's a lot of people around like this, and I know, you know, we've done half an hour and we've gone on about Jeff Bezos, and I think that's fantastic, because a lot of people don't know what his background is. I try telling people that Jeff Bezos is not. I've tried listening to some of his lectures or talks, and he doesn't say anything.
Yeah, but it's basic. They need to make it as well, because for us, like, we don't see any of this. So what we don't know, we don't know. What we see is like, oh, if we want to go to music, we have to go over there, and we don't think about who owns that. Oh, it's these corporations, and then that corporation, and then that corporation, and then that, and then that guy on top. Now, only now. Yeah,
people listen to it.
And now it's built up. Now it's built up to a point where everything are divvied up as much as you think. And see who are the people at the top of each of these industries are. And then when you follow them back, you can see all those industries. One thing that my work concentrates on really is trying to trace back the people who come up with these ideas first and solidify them in reality, you know, a lot of it, like, you can have a think tank full of people who come up with really, really clever stuff, but until someone puts them in that place and says, this is what you got to do, Buster, if you want to be at the top, that doesn't happen. Well, that happens. They get put into the issues. Jeff Bezos is a perfect example of, and other people, you know.
One of the good examples of that is Thomas Edison, the light bulb man, because J.P. Morgan put him in place, basically stole intellectual property, probably, off Tesla, if that's all true as well, but who knows if that's true. But anyway, and they formed then General Electric. And it's the same principle that they're using now. They're just using the same blueprint, aren't they?
Monopoly. Bill Gates and like massive amount of techno of other people and copywriting it, other people's technology, having people like Nathan Mervoid come in and industrially look for problems in people's patents and rewrite the patent without the problem in and say, well, that one doesn't apply anymore. Our patent's the one. Yeah. And just steal other people's inventions off them so that no one can fight you because you're too big and powerful. I mean, we've all seen of Bill Gates rocking backwards and forwards in that court hearing. And I think that was like an example of where they don't expect to be questioned, though. They don't expect their actions to actually be questioned because people are some sort of ethereal power is supposed to be protected way. So when they do into a situation where they have to answer the questions, you see a lot of the time them come in, or you see a co-opting of the issues. And it break. I mean, nowadays they're so professional at it. Twitter, you wanna undermine Twitter. All you've got to do is pretend you're going to buy it, then say information, and then pull out of it, because that's the only way that, yeah. So that point is the thing that's the center of attention. If you just say to them, oh, I want them to just ignore you, to make it into a narrative and a story, the beginning, a middle, and an end. And that's what they know. That's what they know. They know human race has been built on stories. That's what Schwab knows. This is one thing Schwab likes to sit on, likes people to see them sit in this like ivory tower up in Davos, and they're down and they can try, and he uses words like penetrate the cab. And he without shame, any fear, you know, we're going to do all of these things and no one can really stop us. And they like to look like a Bond villain. They like that because for us, for them, kudos. For us, though, it's frustrating, it's angry. It makes a difference between us and them. We become the people who can't do anything, the people with all the power, and they all glorify each other.
When you say the word we, are you meaning the people that can see it? Or all of the people, including the ones that can't see it.
It's a difficult one
because going back to the designer brain damage or lobotomization of society, the person that you were talking about in Monaco, for argument's sake, is not a right lot different from the people that would probably throw you under a bus for not having an injection. And it's the same sort of mindset.
100%, he would throw me under the bus. I one of the things he said to me, he said to me something along my if the world was like I wanted it to be, this is what he saw, what I thought of, and in response I gave him something. But he said that if my vision of the world came true, people would be in town squares having their hands chopped off like it was an Arabic state. And my response to him was, and you would be the ones who are chums, because that is the truth of it. They want the worst fear, and they make it so as well. These people make it so. They make it, and they blame you and the people who can see these things for the reason why it's happening. We have to do these things because of you, because of how you're being, because of us. It's not because we've got an issue. It's not because we want the power and we want the control. It's because you can't behave yourself. You can't be in the world. You can't do too much. So we're going to have to get rid of some of you because you're eating too much, because you can't stop eating too much. Well, they sit there gorging themselves on the best food they can possibly find, that's with all of the soy. Yeah.
It's insane. I mean, I saw a picture of, and I know he's only a bit player, but Leonardo DiCaprio sat on a super yacht, which would be nice. But he's telling, going around the world, flying around in a private jet, which would be nice. Not having to show passports and all the other nonsense that you have to do, and queue up at baggage control, trek like a cow going to a slaughterhouse. But then he's yapping on at the UN, saying, telling us all that we should be using less fuel because we're damaging the world.
While he's
sunbathing on a super yacht.
You could say it looks like
he's a twat.
Paid. He's, it looks like he's maybe winning money for what he's doing. he doesn't actually mean it. He's just another acting role. It's just another.
Yeah.
And he's an actor on the super yacht.
In effect, whether he's getting paid by the UN directly, he is getting paid because it enhances his career. So when it enhances his career, he gets paid more. So he might be doing that bit for free, but not all the other stuff for free. So, yeah, there's a lot. I remember doing some, when we were doing the Young Global Leaders, Sergey Brin was an interesting character. He's directly from Russia. He's a Russian Jewish guy. And his father was a professor in the Soviet Union. And he went to Poland, did some lecture, and went home and decided he wanted to move to America, as you do. So the Russians just let him move. This was in the Cold War in the 80s. And so, I mean, it read like Operation Paperclip 40 years further forward. And he then comes out there and ends up at Stanford, which, as you do. And Sergey Brin then, as we know, Stanford is the hotbed of, it's basically, you could say it's CIA-run Stanford University. It was set up by a eugenicist, for fuck's sake, you know, Stanford University. These things don't happen by chance. There's some group somewhere putting like one of them old telephone things, putting the plugs in, connecting the calls up, making sure these things happen in 10, 15, 20 years' time.
And I researched to help her out, and I ended up going really for the, I think they're called Ashkenazi mafia, which is like the Russian Jewish mafia. So Les Wexner, one of them, and Les Wexner began like a group, getting together groups of people. Ashkenazi Jews did a lot of this, where they got groups of people in America and set up foundations where they would proliferate their power through those
Sephardic Jews.
These are, because I think Sephardic a little bit different, because they're over in,
they split off, didn't they?
Sephardic
Portugal and really stuff like that,
because Sephardic, what they do is they focus on spreading Judaism and living in areas where Judaism isn't. So they are very specific to saying, we're not going to go, like back in the day when there was Judaism in Iraq, Sephardi Jews went over to Iraq. Like the first thing they do. Go on.
They became like court Jews, didn't they? Sephardics. They became the money.
It's very
people,
interesting,
if you like,
how they come into take over certain areas as like a kind of proxy, a conduit for Judaism as a whole, and it's a very interesting stretch of the religion. I did a little bit of research on it recently. I was following a gangster, the life and death of a gangster who was of the Jewish family in the 1950s in London. A guy called Stanley, who ended up being chopped into three parts. His head was chopped off, and his legs, and thrown out of a plane. And they found him wobbling up and down in the water. Yeah, fantastically interesting story. I'll tell you when it's out one day, maybe.
Cheers.
But it's like the eighth or ninth story queued up at the moment, but there's some really interesting stuff. And what you find is they go to places and they took over all of the hoodlumism, you could say. Anything where they could make a bit of money, and it's organized crime. They take over a lot, like the Ashkenazi Russia, who a lot of the mafioso of those. Not all of them, of course. I'm not saying everybody from there. And they'd love to wrap me up in that bowl, wouldn't they? but it's a very clever group of people. They're a very clever group of people. Jewish people have something about being able to capitalize in situations on taking over markets, on setting up businesses and industries, on setting up membership groups and the proliferation of ideas and stuff. You know, they're very good at this. This is something that we can't deny. It's hardly admitted to say, oh, these guys are really, really good at doing all of this stuff all of the time. Well, they also
apparently it is.
Yeah, I know. But they also put it into action. They also go around and they have a structure to send people in all different backgrounds, whether it be Israeli Jews or anything. They have ways of sending people over to capitalize on a vacuum or a piece of land or an area on it, and spread a bit about Judaism and make a base for their own people, which you understand. That's a really clever idea. You know, we've done it all around the world. We've got like communities all around the world. It's not a new thing. The difference is that they're really good. Jewish people in general are really good at making membership groups and organizing, and much better than other societies, ethnicities, races, whatever you want to say, groups. They're much better than most of them. Hence
why they're on top of the pile.
Yeah, they always got their fingers in loads of different pies. They generally control the pies, but they've got enough of a thing that they've got more control than most people. So you know, it's a really I found it really fascinating to follow a load of these Ashkenazi mafioso types, because they don't look like the mafia. They're rewriting history through universities. They're changing people's minds through being tutors, being teachers, and they're doing it in a way which makes sense. Work well and causes them, their group, their individual group, and Judaism to be more powerful. But they're not the top dogs. There's not enough Jewish people in the world to ever be on top. So they're always having to have parts of their groups and parts of their organizations do really corrupt things to undermine others, other groups and other parties or other ethnicities to take the power away. And that's why you see in a lot of different countries a lot of Jewish stuff. Les Wexner is an example of that, really a good example of that. But you see a lot of Jewish mafia.
It always gets me when that side of Judaism is called Ashkenazi. Jews. It always gets me, does that one, but
I'm not about Jews in general. I'm talking about this specific set of people.
There's an elite, isn't it?
Those people don't care about their own people, and they don't care about you or me, and they don't care about anybody. They care about their own wealth. They don't care about people. That's why we're in the situation where they create all of this trouble, and then they leave it and be like, oh, yeah. It's nothing to do with us, by them, and it leads to the Jewish people fighting and being attacked by others for things that really elites do. And that's the same in every culture, same in Schwabia. Yeah. That's the same with Klaus Schwab, who sits there we were talking before this, and we should mention that Klaus Schwab comes from. Go on, sorry.
No, what we're going to say is we will come on to that. I mean, to be fair, I didn't expect to go down this road for 40-odd minutes, so we've covered a lot of ground. And I think in next half an hour, we'll start covering Schwab. One last thing. I've always had this theory, or I don't know what, anyway, that there's several different types of groups where you just spoke about the Jewish groups, and I'm sure there's the black nobility still floating around, maybe the Phoenicians and all these groups that are vying for power like a pit of snakes.
Don't trust those Phoenicians. Those Phoenicians are bad sorts, aren't they? I'm serious. Their history is bad. Go on, sorry.
But they're all like corporate entities where they might join powers for a while. They do then fall out as well. And I think everybody thinks it's one group of people that are running this shit show, but I think there's several groups that are running it from above. And I think we're left down to fight each other, because obviously the order takers and the general public, they police themselves. They don't question anything. They police themselves. Gas bills are going up. Oh, don't worry about that. You know, let's clap on doorsteps. You know, all this type of bollocks that's going on. You know, everybody that runs itself does that. And away from it all, these people are making the big decisions, the decisions that change humans in the next 100 years, 200 years. They know.
Honestly, what you say there is really important, and people just don't understand. Stand is that we're bickering. They've got us bickering. They got us fighting over scraps, literally chomping at each other's ankles, same time, they've got paradigm shift in technology that they're already capitalizing on in the same way that Usenet capitalized on the idea of the creation of the internet. And when they were able to say, well, we can see what's coming now, and we can see it. No one else can see it. So we can already start installing people into the
positions. We can clean up.
Yeah, that's it. We can clean up. That's what they're doing.
Those people aren't going to see it because they can't see further than the fucking eyelashes, sadly, the general public. And it's a sad state of affairs, really. And no matter, Yuri Bezmenov, when he said you could literally take somebody to the doors of gates of a concentration camp in Moscow and they still wouldn't believe you it were a concentration camp in Moscow.
Yeah.
And this was during the Cold War. And we're at that point. The whole world is at that point now. Where they've been that lobotomized over the last, since probably World War II in an aggressive way, but so let's get on to Schwab then, because I know that's why he came on. I know there's a lot of other stuff that we could discuss, but really, Schwab, is it, even as a character, there's a lot of rubbing out in his history, isn't there? You've really got to dig. Some people, you find straight away, and there's lots of it, but with him, you really have to dig away and find the roots, don't you?
Yeah. When I started off, I'd already written like a few like family history of the rich and famous and powerful type like pieces where I followed their family histories, sometimes back like 700 years, successive levels, you know, discovered Bill Gates' direct ancestor was Sir Geoffrey Gates the Fourth, who rode alongside the funeral. The coffin of Henry VIII was one of Henry VIII's courtiers and stuff, you know, and would eventually get his head chopped off on the first day Mary Tudor took office for trying to install Jane Seymour on the throne in the tower, a coup in the state of Britain, like back then in times. These people have a lot, and I was so desperate to know a bit about Klaus Schwab anyway. We were looking at two things. I got to be honest, I'm not sure if I should necessarily say, but me and Whitney were looking at a load of different people that period when I wrote that piece, because that was about the start of 2020, at the end of 2020. But anyway, we were looking at a few different people. One of them, really, we wanted to concentrate on Peter Thiel. We really wanted to get
interesting character. Interesting character.
And all of the people who are surrounding him. Because I did
a Paul Mafia.
But not only some of the people, like he has Eric Weinstein in charge of companies. I'm not sure if it's Palantir, maybe. But anyway, he has a very rich guy. We were trying to work out where we go next, and you know, we really
have you read about the just on a side note. Have you read about him and his partner? I forget the chap's name now. They have meant to have a blood infusion from a 18-year-old every quarter.
Yeah, expect more of that. expect seeing more rich people legal drinking blood. freaky stuff.
And he's also one of his companies is experimenting longevity via parasites.
For them, it's all about transhumanism. That's why they're so interesting. You know, we were trying to work out who to tackle. We were trying to weigh up who's the worst humanist, who's going to be the worst one in the future. Is it going to be Ill or is it going to be Schwab's guys? And we kind of rested on the fact that I could go back into Thiel's past and discover lots about Peter Thiel. I mean, his father's known about, his history is known about, again, go to Germany, really interesting stuff. But there was something about where we were, history, COVID just starting, that Schwab was the big boy. He was a big boy, and went away, and it was pathetic. There's Wikipedia pages, and like tiny. He's like one of the most powerful people in one of the most powerful positions. He's been in Watford since 1971, and it's like turned out to one of the biggest trade organizations. nations in the world, but they barely say anything about him. I looked all around the place and it was all very censored, and it was really well done, because I've done loads of these things, so I can usually break through after a couple of days. They write things up to make you look over there, and if you can read it right, you know that they're making you look over, don't want you to look over there, and they tell you where to look by making you look over there, you know. So that normally you can find it. There was nothing. It was seriously 5 weeks before I got the first, and that's not to write the story, that was before I found the first concrete evidence of who Klaus Schwab's father was, with documentation, name, his brother, his and where, as that was about. There's two things. They're at one point trying to claim back Swiss citizenship. In Schwab's past, or the Schwab family past, his grandfather, Klaus Schwab's grandfather, Jakob Wilhelm Gottfried Schwab, Jakob being
yes.
Jewish name, which you assume that, possibly he was Jewish. Well, he went by the Gottfried Schwab. And what people don't really understand is that he had, I believe he originally went like Baden-Baden, Württemberg. And it had only been about 20, 30 years since he had moved there that it was legal for Jews to walk through there. Jews were banned from walking through large parts of Schwabia and Ravensburg and all of these. If they were caught, they were escorted by the police out, and that only changed, I think it was about 1840, that only changed. In the 1870s, right, when Jakob Wilhelm Gottfried Schwab is becoming a man, he's basically in a situation where he's like, well, I don't want to be known as Jewish, so I should probably drop the name, or at least that's what I assume. And a lot of evidence in what happened later in German history suggests that there may have been a bit of anti-Semitism in that area, yeah, Germany during that time, and onwards. And by 1898, I think it was, he had his child with a Swiss woman. And he had to go to Switzerland and to try and make a thing in Switzerland, which didn't work out well, because once they had the baby, went back to Germany. But to make it in Switzerland, he had to give up his German citizenship. Then he went to apply for Swiss citizenship, but he didn't quite apply for Swiss citizenship. He just lived there for a while, went back up to Germany, and later on in 1950, Klaus Schwab's father, Gottfried's son, Eugen Schwab, was trying to claim back citizenship, saying, well, my father lived there and wanted to become Swiss and given up his German citizenship. Please let us come to Switzerland, because just been working with the Nazis and the war's over and everybody's very angry. You know, that's exactly what it was. It was suddenly, yeah, the war had ended. And for people who don't know, Eugen Schwab was a very clever young man, born in around 1890, brought up in Ravensburg, I believe.
This is Schwab's dad. This is Schwab's father.
Klaus Schwab's father, and he would want to become the manager of the Escher Weiss factory in Ravensburg. Escher Weiss had two main factories, one in Switzerland. It was originally a Swiss company that was set up by a guy called Walter Zupinger. And Walter Zupinger, very clever man. He started off by building machines for doing menial tasks. And by the century, they were making massive turbines for high electric dams. So that's like a big jump in where he was within 30, 40 years. So he's a very interesting man. But they had two. They had Switzerland, and the one that Eugen Schwab was running in the 20s, 30s, and a bit into the 40s during the war, of course. With Escher Weiss in Ravensburg, that was the center of making the headwater turbines for the heavy water atomic bomb production in Norway.
As
the Nazis were trying to beat the atomic bomb, they were doing it with help for this company, which was a model Nazi company, which I think if it was a Bible or is quarterly, that a certain amount of companies companies would be published in the book from about 1936 onwards that were called Nazi model companies, and they were the companies that were the best Nazis around. They're running the best Nazi ways. And so Klaus Schwab's father, Eugen Schwab, was of the main factory where they were, like I say, working on the atomic bomb. You can't get better than that. Once I got to that, I honestly, I shit myself, basically shit myself. I was like, I really expected that 5 weeks of trying to find out who he was to go to waste, to find out he was just the bin man or something, yeah. You know, that he wasn't big. But I when I write any of these articles, I chop away in my own want to find, just I leave that behind very, and I try and just concentrate evidence I can find and build it up from there.
You're going to a zone, don't you, where you're looking for that gem that says,
you can go
further with this now. And you get a few, don't you, like you said, about the nuclear power and his father being a model Nazi and all that. And you look at Schwab and think, well, he looks like a model Nazi. If he had a Nazi suit on, a stormtrooper suit on, he would, that Hugo Boss Black with a skull on it, he would look the part.
At the end of the war, a load of Americans just took all of the information they could find. Will come up again in further reach, I believe, for anybody who looks within that time, to them, him being probably interviewed by either the OSS or the CIA when it first got formed as well, because there was a lot of a big attempt to understand what the Germans were working on during that time. One of the main things, of course. But after the war, Eugen Schwab obviously had been on the wrong side, but had been a really special, important project, but was from a part of the world that was protected during that war, part of Germany that was heavily protected, because it was a special to that area, to Schwabia, to Ravens. There's special dispensation given by the Allies during the war. The Red Cross, the Swiss Red Cross, came along. Oh, we're going to use that place for nice things and for putting people who are in trouble and for humanitarian. Don't bomb there, will you? And the Allies went, oh, of course we won't. And probably stuck in loads of what was really going on there. You know, they allow, the Allies allow these projects to happen as well, so that the old information from them, as did the Nazis, were tried to in the same way.
I don't know if you come across the work of Anthony C. Sutton, Professor Anthony C. Sutton. He wrote a lot of books in the 60s and 70s and into the 80s. He got access to a lot of the information at the Hoover Center, all the legal documentation. And I think he flipped, as in he was straight down the middle, and then he started realizing that the Western bankers, or the Americans and the British, had funded Hitler into not just the Second World War, but Hitler into power and the National Socialist movement, along with the communists. And he wrote a book called Hitler and Wall Street or something like that. It's a fantastic book. It's not a big book. But he documented that IBM were involved and all these companies and the Warburg family, etc. A
couple of really interesting things. Number one, the Warburg name's going to come up again, because the one of the mentors of Schwab eventually under the Kissinger International Seminar was the head of the Warburg School in Harvard.
Another coincidence.
John Kenneth Galbraith, who was, of course, also then involved in two other things. What were you just saying? Oh, right. Also, just before the war, there's two really important. There's the technocratic membership group movement happens in Germany, I believe it was, where they basically said, "Oh, we're now the technocrats. The democracy is going to be the future. There's loads of big technologies, and one day we're going to split the atom. So we need to start getting ready for this." And this was in the early 30s. So they already mapped out that they're going to need to get into a situation where people are going to split the atom. The only way to do that is if you've got a reason for needing to split the atom. And the only way they could see that was war. So I think that the war itself, the putting people into power, whether it be anybody else, putting people into power, making this thing happen, was a means to an end to understand the technological, to get that technology worked on so they could see that new era, because they knew if they split the atom, then it could mean free energy for everybody and all of this, and then all of any war we have will be perfect. Who can get there first? We can only do this sort of experiment, and if we've got something to fear, we can't say, oh, we want to split the bomb to kill loads of people if there's no war happening. That would be stupid. So the only way they can get to that technology and get people into doing that is by enticing them for feeling that they need to get to that technology. And that was done perfectly. That was, it almost like it was rolled out in front of them. There was a democracy movement. There was a want to build atomic weaponry because they knew that the technology was going to be a game. But all of that is like, we get mixed up with the ideology. So we see the Nazis against the
communists,
they're all these different sides, but all of them did that one technology. All of them wanted that one technology, and all of them knew that one technology was going to be sometime in the near future, and whoever got that technology was going to be the winner, was going to be the big man at the end who has everything.
I mean, it's like you mentioned Tim Berners-Lee earlier on, and Tim Berners-Lee's mum and dad, let me get this right, worked on secret radar during the Second World War, and also they worked on the first computer as well. And so the nepotism again gets passed down.
At this point in world history, nearly everything that's written down in books is all about dynasties. It's all about the bloodlines who have done amazing. Oh, this one was terrible. This one was terrible. But this one was amazing. Look what he did. And this one was amazing. And this is what they kind of do. I think they see these things. So Klaus Schwab was seen as someone who potential because Eugene Schwab was so useful, you know. And you'd think he was probably a little bit useful to make them think that was, you know, it goes down the line. This happens in all, they like the dynasties. These rich people especially like to find the best people. Eugen Schwab was an interesting one because just before I do talk about Eugen Schwab, the other thing that was going on in Nazi Germany just before the war that's really interesting and has a massive effect afterwards, but is kind of like, it's hard to explain. So there was people like Leah Bell and one of the Dulles brothers, I think it was John Foster Dulles, who were the sent to Germany before the war broke out because the Nazis had confiscated billions in barrow bonds from that were owned by Americans externally. Because they had stolen that, they went for a court case in Germany in through the German courts. It was actually Cromwell and Sullivan, John Foster Dulles and Alan Dulles's legal firm, working alongside another guy called Laird Bell, who would also help fund a project that Chris and Kissinger would see Schwab come through eventually, was the representing court for these bondholders, and would spend after the war his time in Nazi Germany. They know that events, amazing things come from it. They know it. So how can you make cataclysmic events? You create them.
They know that through trauma comes out new inventions. And because in this realm, for some reason, we've got to endure trauma to actually benefit, which is an odd state of affairs, but that's the fact, isn't it?
Yeah, well, necessity and other invention and all that. Yeah. You know, the only way you create that is by making people think that they're going to die if they don't need it, if they don't get it. Yeah. And I think that what's interesting is what happens afterwards, because afterwards, by the 1950s, and I don't know if you read the second piece, the Dr. Kissinger or How Taught Me to stop worrying and love the bomb.
Did you write that just after this one?
The second part of Schwab. A year afterwards, it took me. It basically proved that Kissinger's course that Klaus Schwab went through at Harvard was CIA funded through a conduit called the American Friends of the Middle East, which was set up by Kermit Roosevelt in 1951 or 1952. Helpments, that's what Kermit Roosevelt used to do. He was OSS. He was one of the first people to be in the CIA. He was the grandson of Theodore Roosevelt. At the time, of course, Franklin Roosevelt is in power during the war, but Franklin Roosevelt is like the fifth cousin or seventh cousin or something of Theodore Roosevelt. It's like distant families, but they're all to do with all of these different things. But basically, there's loads of connections that show the co-opting of these technologies, of training, of ways of MIP groups and other groups.
But it's like they've for the last 150 years they were doing it in distance of every little project they had going on, and the World Economic Forum's like, right, we'll put them all together, and it's now one big project. Sky.